Accession number 29238, reel number 8.
Mr. Wiggum, reel 8.
And the Changi area, of course, was the peacetime barrack area for the British Army. And the big Roberts barracks there.
Can you describe them? What were they like?
I think they were three-storey. They were big, sort of concrete, long concrete buildings, very open, sort of verandas, and big open spaces for air, you know. They were good sound building, and good billets. I mean, you know, for the peacetime soldier, when they had proper beds and things, they were a good, solid sound billet. And the Roberts Barracks had made into a hospital for the all the battle wounded. And
was it a large camp?
Oh, I wouldn't. I think of somewhere around about 16,000 to 20,000 in it, I think. It was a big area, you know. And we all, some were in tents, which the Japs let our fellows collect from our own gear. They did give a time, a deadlock time, by which no outside communication would be allowed, and before that we were able to get anything into the camp which we could, stores and one thing and other, you know, that they had one or two trucks and used to run down into the city and get stuff from headquarters, stores and things, and bring that in, medical stuff and food and one thing and other. And then after this particular time limit, that was stopped, you know. But they gave us that day to, largely, I think, not because they were being very thoughtful or humane, but because they had no means of dealing with us themselves. They had to try to make us self-sufficient until they got their breath back and decided what they were going to do with all these blokes. And at the hospital, they, at that time, had a reasonable amount of medical stuff. And go to hospitals down in Singapore. The most notorious one was the Alexander Hospital, I think it was the Alexander they called it, which was an Australian hospital. And whether it's right that some retreating Indian troops set up a machine gun post in the grounds or not, I don't know. That's a tale that went round. But at any rate, the Japs just went berserk and went in and bayoneted the patients in the beds and the doctors, and, you know. And I mean, that is a fact, because I worked later with the Australian who had been a medical orderly, and he had the wound there where he was bayoneted, and all that saved him was that he passed out and they left him for dead. But he had the gash there where he'd been bayoneted, poor lad. That it's an awful lot of that.
What were the men's reactions on being taken into captivity? And your own reactions?
I think everybody was just a bit dumbfounded and confused, you know. I think nobody really knew just what the position had been and why we'd given up. You know, the reasons why we packed up was we're getting short of everything. The Japs had control of the main water supply, which is a bit desperate in a climate like that. Our artillery was down to, I think, about 10 rounds a gun or something of the sort. And civilians were being killed by the hundred with these bombs, you know, slaughter with the civilians. And then the Japanese, the Yamashita, the general at the time, he told General Percival to open his strait that if you don't surrender, then when we've finally conquered you, we'll just exterminate all Western folks on the island, troops and civilians and everything else. And they knew from experience up country in Malaya that they would have done. And so in the end, I mean, Percival had no option other than to just pack up, because we were getting no supplies. We couldn't get any supplies by sea or land or air or any other way. You see, that's another thing people don't realize. We had no air cover. What the RAF had, and they had no modern stuff, had been shot out of the skies. Booster buffaloes and things like that, you know, against the Japanese Zero, which was about the equivalent of the Hurricane, Gloucester Gladiators, and they had three Hurricanes, I think, and we wondered, it didn't seem like the RAF, why on earth every time there was an air raid, they took off and went hell for leather in the opposite direction. We thought, this is mighty funny, until we got talking to the RAF lads afterwards, and they had no guns. They had the planes, and they had the guns, but they were short of artificers to fit them. They didn't fit them onto the planes. And so they were trying to save the planes. They couldn't fight, so they just got out of it and came back. But it was hopeless. They actually had a World War One blimp on the end of a string on the other side of the causeway, sitting up there watching us. You're not going to knock it down with. But, you know, you felt terribly vulnerable.
You had no way of defending yourself.
Not from the air, no. Not at all. But, so Percival just had no option, poor fella.
Was there a fear about being taken into captivity by the Japanese?
Well, I don't know about others, but there wasn't particularly amongst us, because we were a bit naive, you know. And we thought, oh, well, you know, they're a fairly civilised race. You know, they're not fully westernised, but, you know, they're accepting a fairly civilised race. But we soon learned how deep their civilisation went. But they're absolute shockers.
So what were those first few days like when you were two?
Well, we were just busy getting ourselves sorted out and bedded down and one thing or the other, you know, because that was just left to us. As long as we didn't try to get out or anything ourselves, the Japs just left us to get organised ourselves. And
so you were left to your own devices?
We were, yes. And it wasn't long before they started to take working parties down to the city on clearing up jobs and that sort of thing, you know.
So how did you get yourself organised and your particular troop?
As I say, it was the peacetime barrack area, and so there were married quarter bungalows and that, and houses, and they were empty, of course, no furniture, I think, and we got billeted into those. Yes, we were billeted in the in these houses, so that we had a decent roof over our heads, you know. But we were just, well, until we got into those, there was a good few nights we just slept on a concrete floor, and I've got backache too from the chill of it, you know.
And what about food? What did you do for food?
Well, the Japs started issuing us with rice It was our first introduction to rice. And as I say, they managed to get a bit of food up from the town. And so we were just on very sparse rations. But we just got that one, what we were given, the rice, and perhaps again a bit of stew or something of the sort, you know.
We were still together as a unit.
Oh, yes. Yes, we were still a regiment together, in batteries, of course, and troops.
And how many men do you think were there all together in this camp that you described?
In Changi, and I say there must have been getting on for about 20,000, I think. And then there were other camps, you know, that...
So where did they come from? What other units were they from, can you remember?
Oh, dear. I mean, there were the Australians, there were the British units that had been out there as regulars, the Argyll and Southern Highlanders, the Gordon Highlanders, and then there were the Hong Kong bloke, the Shanghai fellows who managed to get out of there. They all had come piling in, you see. And it's difficult to say without looking at records just how many regiments that were there all together. The Manchesters were there, and various artillery regiments, of course.
Did you get much chance to speak to other people and learn about their experience?
Oh yes, I mean, we were just walking around the area all day, you know. You could chat to anybody you met, and the Japs didn't bother you as long as you weren't bothering them. I mean, you know, you got big padangs or playing fields, you'd wander around there and down to the
city.
What
else did you do to fill your time in?
Well, there was always, while the short time we were there, comparatively short time, there was always something to do, to trying to get the place made habitable, you know, and better. And then, actually, they tried to start a university, you know, and, well, you could go for a bit of education and one thing or another. Well, I joined that just to fill the time in a bit. And, I hadn't been there long when I was took on one of these back downtown parties. And I went down to a camp called River Valley, where they had a lot of these lads on the working parties.
And what was that?
I was just cleaning up, you know, cleaning up the place.
What sort of state was it
then? Singapore, it was parts of an awful mess, you know, from the bombing. Just, well, you see it on the television now, Baghdad and places, you know, except the bombs weren't quite as big, and that was the ones the Yanks go throwing around.
So can you explain a typical day on one of these working parties?
Well, again, you know, it just sounds so you can't remember what you were doing, but the whole thing was such, it was so changeable. You could be on half a dozen different jobs in the day, a short one, and then somebody would come along, you know, and haul you off to do something else. And you might be on that for a little bit. And remember carrying timber at one time, and then wheeling wheelbarrows, and just... The Japs themselves had no really set plan, I don't think. The job was so big, they just sort of got you into an area and got cracking and started to clear it up, you know. So you were moved just wherever they wanted you at the time. But again, I wasn't down in the River Valley long when I got a nasty attack of bronchitis. And I was shot back up to Changi and into the Roberts Hospital. And I was in there a little bit till it cleared up. And then I went back to my old billet, and the, some of the lads were still up there, of course, in at Changi. So the lads, I didn't go back down to the city. I was in there, and I was there when they started forming these parties for Thailand. You know.
So how long were you there in that particular camp?
Well, on and off from going down and coming back again and that. I think, as far as I can remember, I think we were there about 3 months, something like that. Can't remember just what date we went up to Thailand, but they started forming these working parties to go up.
How had you been fed up to that point by the Japanese?
Oh,
it sounds fairly relaxed.
It was, as long as, you know, in the Changi area, it was. One of the biggest problems, you know, they had Sikhs who had turned over to the Japs. They were mainly sort of volunteers from the Sikh taxi drivers and folks down in the city, and some of the real genuine Indian troops said they never dare go back home, and they were guards. There was a road in between our area and the hospital, Robert Barracks area, and if you were going across there, you had to form. You couldn't just go across. You had to form a party, and with these Sikhs, and when they got so many, they let this party across. And of course, they were the big boys then, you know. Until one of our staff majors, Major Ski, and he came along. And he'd been out in India a long time, and he spoke fluent Urdu. And he dressed them down just the way he might have done on the parade ground, and they just stood and shivered. They'd dollared, they were scared stiff of ski. And so they behaved themselves when he was around. But that was the only place where it could get a little bit awkward, going from the one area to another past these confounded Sikhs. Because, I mean, the other Sikh regiments were cracking good blokes, you know. But these were just rabble, really, that had joined up. That,
so did you have much to do with the Japanese guards in this?
Not at that period, no. No, we weren't in contact with them much at all, because they were way down on the perimeter watching around. In fact, I don't know whether they had an awful lot there, to be perfectly honest, because we didn't see them wandering around the place much. That I think they knew pretty well we couldn't go anywhere, you know. And then my CO, Colonel Dean, he was detailed off to form one of the working parties to go up to Thailand. Colonel Dean's Tea Party. They all had letters. I thought it was some blooming tea party too, bless him. But, so I hadn't been of a long, long time out of hospital with the bronchitis. That I could have skipped it, you know. The MO said to me, "Do you want to go with them?" I said, "Yes." He said, "You know, you could stay back, lad." He said, "You're still not 100%." I said, "No," but I said, "They're all my mates." I said, "If I stay back, I'm staying back on my own." I said, "I'd rather go with the lads I've been with ever since 1939." You know, and so I joined this tea party, and we went off, and we were transported down to Bangkok station.
How many of you were there?
Ooh, I don't know. At a rough guess, there must have been 200 or 300, I think, in the party. It was a good-sized working party, you know.
Do you know what you were going to do and where you were going?
All sorts of funny tales have gone around, you know, how we're going to be much better off up there, you know. In fact, at one period, we were going to be in billets with running water and electricity. Tales got around, you know. And no indication at all of what we were sticking our necks into. But I had no choice. They wanted a party. They said, you're going, and you went. And we went down to Bangkok Station. And we were packed in, I think it was 28 men to a truck, into steel cattle trucks. And then they shut the doors on us. I thought, God, this is going to be lovely in the sun, with the heat, you know. But fortunately, somebody, senior Jap officer, must have had some common sense. Our officers got at them. And before we left, they came along and they opened the doors, you know, some that air. And we set off on, I think it was a three-day train journey up Malaya, if I remember rightly, because we weren't going terribly fast.
What was that journey like?
Pretty rough, believe me, because, you know, you had no toiletry facilities at all. I mean, washing without, no. And if a bloke wanted a pee, he just stood at the open door and got on with it. And if you wanted anything else, then it was a combined operation, because you stood with sort of your heels on the edge, and two of the lads, one hung onto each arm and lowered you out, and there you were, hanging out there, doing your stuff. I was doing mine one day when we passed through a station, and the folks on the station, they must have had a lovely sight. And that was it. I mean, you had to get on with it. And we did get a wash out once a day, perhaps. We used to stop for rations at the station, you know, that have the rice and that they cooked already ahead of us, rice and stew. And then, you know, you'll have probably seen them, you're old enough to have seen them, the elephant trunk water fillers for the trains, you know, they had those there. And we used to get a wash underneath there, because, I mean, we were only in our shorts or something, and they soon dried. So we used to get a good shower underneath one of those things.
I bet that was most welcome.
It was, it was. And we'd had a smallish issue of Red Cross stuff just before we left. So and we had some powdered cocoa. So we used to get the cocoa into a mug and go along to the engine, and the driver used to open the blowdown valve, you know, and shoot some water out of the boiler into your pot. Well, of course, I don't know how sophisticated the railways were there, but I mean, at the power station, there were chemical treatment put into the boilers to prevent corrosion and one thing or another, and that stuff all came out of the blowdown, you know. Now, whether that was so, the trains, anyway, it was still here. And so we got these cups of hot cocoa, and now when we stopped. And it was about 3 days that went on.
Is that the only food you had?
Unless we nibbled into a little bit of Red Cross rations, but we were very sparing with those as long as we were getting. We got about twice a day we stopped to the rice, you know, not just one meal.
What did you do in the night time?
Well, you tried to sleep.
Did the train stop?
No, no, no. Carried on. And with 28 of you in the van. You sort of slept against each other, you know, and you tried to get a bit of rest.
Was there enough space to lie down?
There wasn't really, you know. Because a narrow gauge railway there, not like ours. And we carried on the way up over the border at Alastair and on towards Bangkok and stopped at a place called Bampong. And there we detrained. And it was a transit camp. Thank goodness it was a transit camp only, because we waded through water, it was flooded, and into these ramshackle huts with bamboo lats as beds, and you lay down on that just a few inches above the water level for the night, you know. And then they took us by bus up through Kanchanaburi. No, lorries they were, not buses. And we went to a spot which wasn't a camp then. We had to start building some of the huts. And it finished up as Chun Kai Camp, one of the base camp for number two working group. We were number two working group. And Chun Kai finished up a very big camp. There were, towards the end of the line being built, there were 8,000 or 9,000, I think, in that camp. It was very big. Everybody was evacuated down to Chun Kai, you know.
There wasn't much there when you first arrived?
No, there wasn't at all. But again, we weren't there very long, and this is the railway really they're interested in, so somebody else must have to come along and finish that camp off.
So what work did you do there at that camp?
We started building these bamboo huts and that, you know.
Can you describe them? What were they like?
The majority of them had a row of centre poles down the middle, and sort of triangular framework over there, and then bamboo runners, its place of rafters, and atap leaf cladding on top of that as roofs. And then inside, about 18 inches or so from the ground, there were platforms built of just bamboo and split bamboo canes put along these, and they were just long, unbroken, along the length of the hut. And they were living and sleeping quarters and everything else, you know, and I don't know how much space you had. Well, it'd be about 6 foot or deep, I suppose. And when you're in a full hut, you wouldn't have more than 2'6" per man, I shouldn't think, you know.
How many men in a hut then?
About 400, I think, in the biggest huts. They were usually in three sections, or one long hut, but there were doorways, you know, breaking up into sections. And that was typical of the camps all the way up. I don't know whether the back of that book, the bit out of the medical journal that I stuck in, whether the sketches there by a lad called Searle gives you an idea, because he was very, very good of the that's what they were like. Earth floors, of course. So when they got dry, there was dust all over the place. But that was it. That's what we lived in for 3.5 years. That from one camp to the other. But as I say, the Chun Kai site, after a day or two there, they moved us up just a kilometre or two